Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Whatever message the flotilla of pro-Palestinian activists was sending as it steamed toward Gaza, whatever message the Israeli government was sending when it ordered in its commandos, they all got the attention of the world for Israel, widespread condemnation in the aftermath, for the organizers of the flotilla, a terrible death toll, and a public relations victory. This hour On Point, a bloody raid in the Mediterranean and its aftermath. You can join the conversation. Have you taken on board this story of relief flotilla and raid? Where are your sympathies in the event, in the aftermath? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go first this hour to Jerusalem and Janine Zakaria, bureau chief there for the Washington Post. Janine, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
How is Israel taking on board this global wave, I guess you'd have to say, of condemnation at this point?
Well, yeah, officials here in Jerusalem obviously very anxious about the growing condemnation of Israel, both of the United Nations and Europe and elsewhere. The extremely difficult situation right now with Turkey, a very important Muslim ally of Israel. Countries starting to suspend diplomatic relations, the first being Nicaragua so far. And there's a lot of soul-searching here, I would say, Tom, not about the rightness of trying to stop the flotilla from coming here, but about how they went about it. And more importantly, as you often see in similar situations after Israel carries out some sort of mission like this that's controversial, could we have done a better job explaining it, and why are people so upset with us? This is really the core question that's being asked, I think, inside the Prime Minister's office and in the foreign ministry.
New polls out on Israeli public opinion since the raid. What do they say, Janine?
Yeah, this morning, fresh polls, the first poll since the action Monday, early Monday morning here, showed that most Israelis are still very supportive of Prime Minister Netanyahu. 89% said that he should not resign. Similarly, with Defense Minister Ehud Barak, while there were calls in the Israeli press immediately that he should resign because of the botched raid, three-quarters of Israelis saying he should remain in power. Where there's a split, however, is that more than 63%, I believe, said that the Israeli Navy should have used a different tactic to try and stop the flotilla.
What about that? Everybody's examining these videos. People are putting out different videos. But what about the assessment in Israel of the execution of this effort to stop the flotilla? Is the military doing some self-criticism here? I mean, after all, they can't be very happy with at least the diplomatic outcome of the raid.
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation, Tom. As you know, I mean, the military in Israel is very holy, and people are very reluctant to criticize the Israeli military for operational planning. I spoke to a very senior naval commander late last night who said, look, if there was any error, as you can say, is that they did not expect to be attacked so violently when the commandos landed on the ship. I imagine that people in the States have seen some of the videos of the commandos being lowered down from helicopters on board and then being beaten quite violently. So that was where they said they made an error. Now, they did anticipate that with this particular ship, the Turkish ship, the Marmara, that they would have more resistance than they had, say, on other free Gaza flotillas where you had people from Oakland, California, and other places. This was, you know, sort of a hardcore, more radical group they were describing in the run-up to it. But they did not expect it to be as violent and to turn as deadly as it did, of course.
I'm reading here commentary in Haaretz in Israel calling this so severe a debacle. Here's Amos Harel saying the damage Israel has caused itself internationally can hardly be exaggerated. Is that just Haaretz, or is that a widespread concern?
There's certainly feelings, I would say, in a lot of the leading Israeli commentators that this is a mess public relations-wise. But what you haven't seen here as a result of all this, and I think this is an important point to stress, is any real serious reevaluation of Israel's policy towards Gaza, whether the blockade is working, whether there are other ways to protect Israel, to prevent the Hamas-led leadership from arming without creating these kinds of scenarios. And this is the question, I believe, that not only the Israeli press is trying to explore, but I mean nobody in the government is actually exploring it. They're more focused on the reputational damage right now and the tactical errors in on the ship. And what I can tell you is that the United States and others are in close confrontation with the Israelis to look at ways to prevent this kind of incident from happening again. You've got at least two more ships en route this week, so we could see a round two of confrontation very soon.
The death toll at this point, we're hearing 9 or 10. We're reading different accounts. What's the latest number that you have, Janine?
Nine deaths. And this is another interesting problem that we faced here reporting on the story. The story has been managed quite closely by the Israeli military, and we haven't even got the identities of the dead yet. But I was assured by an official here that all nine were Turks. And there was, as you recall, on Monday, a lot of confusion about the death toll, precisely how many were dead. You had Israeli spokesmen say themselves that they thought 15 had been killed. So obviously it was a very confused situation early on, but so far nine dead. The main thing that's going on here today is that after a decision late last night by Prime Minister Netanyahu's Security Cabinet, all 600 or so activists are being deported within the next 48 hours. So you already had 200 Turks return, another 100 or so Arabs from countries, I might add, that don't have any relations with Israel. So you had them deported via Jordan, Israel's neighbor. And they're all being processed, including another 11 Americans who were detained overnight.
Everybody out. And the meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama, rescheduled or just off for now?
Off for now. Again, another major story related to this is that on the eve of all this, this happened rather on the eve of a very crucial meeting that Prime Minister Netanyahu was supposed to have with President Obama. It was being billed here as a makeup session, quote unquote, after
right.
3 months of extraordinary tension between the U.S. and Israel over settlement construction.
Is Israel worried that this whole huge negative response could blow up the consensus the U.S. has been trying to build to bring sanctions against Iran on the nuclear front, Janine?
Yes, I think that is starting to sink in here, that is a concern. And that if anything, if it doesn't undercut it, which I believe that it certainly may, is that it just makes it a lot harder for the United States to build that kind of consensus. I mean, there's just so many angles in terms of how this is going to affect Israel diplomatically, and as you point out, potentially on the Iran issue, which, as Prime Minister Netanyahu himself repeatedly points out, is his primary strategic concern. Nevertheless, you have these issues like the Freedom Flotilla or construction in East Jerusalem, which prevent him from successfully moving forward on the Iran issue with the United States.
Janine Zakaria with The Washington Post in Jerusalem. Janine, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Joining me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is retired U.S. Ambassador Edward Peck. He was aboard one of the ships in the flotilla, the Svendoni, not the one on which the serious clashes and the deaths occurred. He was deported and flown back to the United States yesterday. Edward Peck, thank you very much for joining us. Why were you on one of these boats?
Well, I describe myself, when I get the opportunity, as a Middle East expert, Tom, and I say this with some confidence because, unlike most Americans, I know where it is. And I've been working on that part of the world for a large part of my adult life, mostly with words, and I decided I would like to contribute to something a little more tactile, something that you could see, like the humanitarian effects we were trying to, articles we were trying to get into Gaza. That was the reason. It's not like I hadn't been there before. I've been there many times.
Of course. What was the outcome you were hoping for, Ambassador Peck, and what do you think of what actually happened?
Well, the first question first, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
We were hoping, you know, maybe it was a fuzzy puppy kind of hope, that maybe doing what we were doing as a humanitarian gesture, which was not in any way religious or political or anti or hostile to Israel, just to give Israel a chance to say, hey, okay, we will let the cargo boats in. You other people coming with us, you wait out here. They don't need you, but we'll get the stuff in there and deliver it and do something that would earn a little approval rather than opprobrium from the rest of the world. We were sadly mistaken. My major reaction when it all happened on our ship was disappointment. And yet I see now, a few days later, I just got home yesterday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I see that some of the things that happened I saw a comment somewhere where Prime Minister Netanyahu said they might consider loosening the blockade, and Egypt has opened up the other side, and pressures grow, and the Israelis are certainly not dummies. They may see that it could be to their advantage to let the Rachel Corrie go in.
The Rachel Corrie, one of the next boats coming across the Mediterranean. Israel has said that it's charged there's connections here between the flotilla and Hamas, even Al-Qaeda. What do you say to that?
Well, what did we expect them to say? That we were all, tree-hugging flower children? Of course they said we were all armed to the teeth terrorists. I mean, that's the position I would expect the Israeli government to take to explain what it did. But the people on board the ship that I was on, the ones that I got to know in 5 or 6 days of rather close coordination, were all of the humanitarian variety, saying, you know, this is a thing we are doing for the people of Gaza who are suffering. It's a humanitarian effort. Don't read it any other way.
And what did you read of the video of the reception that the Israeli soldiers got when they rappelled down onto the big ship?
Let me ask you a question, Tom. If tomorrow night at your home some people come in armed to the teeth into your home, what are you going to do? The people on the ship, forgive me for putting it just they were defenders, not attackers. Here I am on this ship in international waters. There's 600 of us, men and women, and maybe some children. And here come a bunch of people onto the ship uninvited, illegally, to take it over and take us to Israel where we don't want to go. Are we supposed to strew rose petals at their feet? And what did they use? My God, some of them used deck chairs.
Yeah. Edward Peck, we've seen the video, and it's not pretty. You were on one of the boats. We thank you for joining us today. Ambassador Edward Peck, a retired U.S. career diplomat who was aboard the flotilla. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the uproar over Israel's show of force in the Mediterranean, the blockade of Gaza, a relief flotilla, and this week's bloody pushback. Whatever was intended, the diplomatic pushback and public pushback around the world has been severe. Here's the sound of just one of the protests that erupted around the world as news of the flotilla death toll spread. This demonstration took place yesterday in Istanbul, Turkey. Relations between Israel and Turkey continuing to deteriorate by all reports today. Joining me now in the studio is Ehud Eran, an Israeli international research fellow at the Belfer Center at Harvard's JFK School of Government, reserve major in the Israeli army. He served on then Prime Minister Ehud Barak's foreign policy staff. Ehud Eran, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank is Diana Boutu. She's an advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team that was in Taba and other peace talks, has been. She's an Arab citizen of Israel, now living and practicing law in the West Bank. Diana Boutu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And from Paris, we're joined by Christopher Dickey, Mideast regional editor for Newsweek magazine. Chris Dickey, welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Chris, first to you. The response in Europe has been pretty universally terrible. Maybe that's not surprising, but is this a bigger uproar than we've seen in past incidents in the Middle East?
Well, it's bigger, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is a lot of people were killed. 9 people were killed. Secondly, it was just such a fiasco of an operation. It's one thing if people are killed in an Israeli operation that seems to succeed in achieving its main goals, and people sort of grudgingly admit that sometimes Israel has to do this kind of thing in a very rough neighborhood. It's another thing when you have one Israeli operation after another that causes a lot of bloodshed, a lot of suffering, as we saw in Lebanon in 2006, in Gaza in 2008, 2009, and now on a smaller scale on the high seas, and Israel fails to achieve its objectives. In fact, it just boxes itself ever more tightly in a corner. I think the fiasco is the word that's being used almost universally in the European press right now.
Diana Boutu, in Ramallah, how do you see the consequences of this playing out within the Palestinian community? And, of course, that is physically divided between West Bank and Gaza, politically divided as well. But what consequences do you see within the Palestinian world here of this?
Well, this is another example of how really the Palestinian community is much more united than people would have it believe. That there's been universal condemnation both from Hamas and from Fatah, and the Palestinian citizens of Israel have also similarly awakened and are becoming very united on this issue. It's not just a question of Palestinians becoming united, but I think that the world is beginning to wake up and realize that this isn't simply a case of Israel's aggression against Palestinians, but that it will go to extreme lengths to continue to uphold a blockade that has been considered illegal. So it's not simply one that is Palestinian, but it affects everybody within the region, and the world, I think, is beginning to realize that. And most certainly the Palestinians have long ago realized this.
Ehud Iran, you've sat in these circles. Of course, Ehud Barak gave the go-ahead when those Israeli special forces were in big problems on the deck of the ship. At least it looks that way in the video. Whether it was big enough to go to lethal force, whether they should have been there in that way in the first place, perhaps different questions. But what's your interpretation of the outcome of what's happened here?
I see three avenues for outcomes that we should follow. One is the immediate outcomes coming out of the event. Specifically, will there be any accountability? Will Defense Minister Barak be under political challenge? There's already voices in his own party calling for his resignation. The second potential ramification is a broader conversation on the siege or the blockade. Should Israel continue the blockade? We heard from Jerusalem that the conversation did not start in government circles, but in the public sphere it's already going. Amos Oz, one of Israel's leading moral voices, mm-hmm. called this morning in Haaretz for the lifting of the blockade. And finally, there are secondary blowback questions, the effect on Israeli-Turkish relations, the sense of isolation in the world, and potentially even an effect on Israeli-American relationship.
Which has seen a lot of stress in its own terms lately. I mean, Christopher Dickey, this is getting a lot of attention now. There's been a series of measures taken that may or may not, you know, have been necessary, but the net effect has been more diplomatic isolation and a lot of comment now on just how extreme that isolation has become for Israel.
Well, I think that's right, and I think it's a particularly critical question for the United States, because a big part of the dynamic that we've seen between the Netanyahu government and the Obama government has to do with Iran and Netanyahu's concerns about Iran and the always implicit threat that Israel might go to war against Iran and force the United States to join it. All of that looks very awkward now if you look at the record of the Israeli military over the last several years, and if you look at a little operation like this. I mean, they were going up against unarmed people. Okay, they had wooden staves and monkey wrenches, mm-hmm. but essentially you had a crack commando unit going up against a very poorly armed crowd and getting the crap kicked out of it. That doesn't look good, just like it didn't look good when they went up against Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006. And if this is the government that's saying we can handle Iran by ourselves or we can go to war with Iran, well, I think people have to look at that and say, are you kidding? Are you going to go to war with Iran? Is this the army that's going to go to war with Iran? There's only one way you could have a strategy to go to war with Iran, and that would be to drag the United States into a third war in the Muslim world. And I think all of that weighs on the relationship very heavily right now, and a lot of it is in the minds of the American people, not just the minds of the American government.
There's the range of issues, from the melee on the deck of that ship, the big one in the flotilla, all the way to potential war with Iran. It's quite a buffet. Let's go to our listeners.
But it all comes from the same basic mindset of the Netanyahu government, Tom, mm-hmm. which is we're going to do what we have to do, and the rest of the world be damned.
We'll talk about whether that outlook is working for Israel. I want to get our listeners in here, if I may. Catherine, Northampton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Catherine.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to say that, first of all, the siege, the blockade of Gaza is illegal. It's collective punishment against the people of Gaza for democratically voting in Hamas. And second of all, the commandos, the Israeli commandos invading those ships, which were in international waters, was illegal too. It was an act of piracy. and the people on those ships had every right to defend themselves under all international law.
Two legal points, and let us pick them up. Of course, the siege, there were elements of it after the election of Hamas, is true. It was radically tightened, I think, after Hamas kicked Fatah out and took over in Gaza. But Ehud, Iran, what about the legal questions here? This was way out in international waters. I've seen the legal case made that be, but how do you look at it?
So the Israeli formal position, which I do not necessarily share, states that the blockade is not a collective punishment, but rather an effort to stem the flow of arms into the Gaza Strip. And Israel points out to the fact that since 2005, more than 3,000 rockets were shelled on civilian targets in Israel.
But there may be intent, but effect could still be collective punishment.
Could be, but Israel points out to its right to defend itself and stem this flow of arms. Secondly, the blockade, says the Israeli position, is a recognized international procedure, and you are allowed under the rules that the Israeli government is quoting to board, search, and potentially arrest ships that intend to break a blockade even from the moment they leave a port, assuming they signal they plan to break the blockade.
Gianna Buttu, in Ramallah, what's your interpretation? Part of the goal here has been to weaken Hamas with this blockade. Is that working?
First of all, the blockade itself is not legal. It is actually, in fact, illegal. It is collective punishment, which is considered to be a war crime. Goldstone, in his report before the UN, came to the exact same conclusion. And I think it's important to keep in mind that what Israel is blocking out, or what it's, I think it's probably more accurate to talk about what they're allowing in, is simply a mere 81 goods that are used to sustain life, and that's it. For example, canned vegetables are allowed, but canned fruit is not allowed. And the list goes on. Strawberries are allowed, but coriander is out. So there's really nothing that is linked at all to security or any of those sorts. Because the Palestinians are under military occupation, Israel cannot use the defense that it is a blockade that is legal. Israel is supposed to be actually protecting the Palestinians, not imposing blockades on them. But going back to your question as to whether it's actually harming Hamas or strengthening Hamas, the one issue that has united Palestinians all throughout now is that the blockade is illegal. It doesn't matter what the intent is. It doesn't matter what the effect is. But that what needs to be done is for this blockade to be lifted. And insofar as Israel is actually believing that this is creating greater division within Palestinian society, they're very sadly mistaken. It's actually creating more unity within Palestinian society.
Christopher Dickey, I want to get you on this, but a couple of callers first, please. Ariel in Worcester, Massachusetts. Ariel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First of all, great show, great program. I wanted to just point to the fact that right now there's a big issue between the Turkish and Israeli relationship. It has been
huge.
Very good. Right now things are tourism. There are a lot of tourists that go from Israel to Turkey. Obviously, both the United States has a relationship with Israel and with Turkey. Those are right now both in jeopardy. I think the whole blockade, the flotilla there, was something that already was known, that there was going to be a political conversation afterwards. It's a shame that there was a loss of life. But again, Israel has already stopped recently two ships with tons of weapons that were being used by terrorists, both Hamas and Hezbollah. There was the Karen A ship a few years back. And recently, November 2009, tons of weapons that were stopped by Israel. So,
but they let other relief boats through, but not these. That's interesting in itself, and we'll look at it. Ariel, thanks for your call. I want to get one more right here from Charleston, South Carolina. Dominique, you're on the air.
Yes. My comment is kind of conferring with the gentleman before. It is not against international law for countries in times of war to check vessels, even though they are in international waters, if they're at times of war, and Israel is and has been since its birth, since 1948. I believe that if they were really hostile towards these activists, and there would have been more incidents than just on one out of the six ships that they had checked, and I believe that this is just a situation for people to be more against Israel in a way, looking for another reason you know, to condemn the government.
Do you think Israel handled this well, Dominique? Do you think this was well handled?
I mean, they might have gone, a little way, but this is in no way should, you know, have anything, you know, break the bonds, you know, that it slightly has with Turkey. I think that, you know, if Turkey...
But it's doing that. It appears to be doing that.
If this is the case, then maybe the bonds that, you know, that they had were never strong. Maybe they're looking for a reason, you know, to get out of this. Because, I mean, Israel is a very hated country by many nations. And I believe that if the Israeli government were really hostile to those activists, then there would have been more instances than just one out of the six ships.
Dominique, thanks for your call. And one more, then I want to go to Paris. Jerry in Brattleboro, Vermont. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yes, I think it's an outrage, and I think I'm totally against the whole situation. It seems that Netanyahu was and is a warmonger, and they will do anything to take their land back. But see, people forget, if you look at the old maps before 1948, Israel didn't even exist. That was all Palestine, Assyria, Persia, etc., etc. And to me, this is nonsense. And why is the America being in lockstep with Israel? What do we owe that country? How many more countries are we going to support when we can't even take care of two wars as it is now?
Jerry, we've got the perspective. Of course, you know, Israelis point way back further, but that's what all the contention is about, I guess. Chris Dickey, there you are. You hear the questions that come up right away about legality and what Israel has a right to do and not do here, and what the consequences are for Hamas' strength, ultimately.
Well, look, let's step back from it for a minute and not get into the legal disputes. I mean, obviously, Israel will argue this one way. Palestinians will argue it another way. Ban Ki-moon will argue it another way. Mm-hmm. He has called for a lifting of the blockade on Gaza. The UN Secretary General. So there's a lot of dispute there. But what's absolutely clear is that this was a botched operation. Now, the woman, Dominique, who called from Charleston and said, you know, obviously if the Israelis had wanted to kill activists and set out to do that, they could have killed a lot more. That's right. They probably could have and would have. I don't think the Israelis who landed on that ship intended to kill anybody. I think they really were attacked by people with clubs and monkey wrenches and maybe kitchen knives. I think that's absolutely true. The problem is they weren't ready for it. They had done a lot of intelligence work. They knew there were no arms, no heavy arms on this ship. They knew they weren't carrying any lethal weapons to Gaza that Hamas wants or needs. They were stopping the shipment because it had cement and iron bars on it, and they say those are potentially lethal. It's this whole bizarre, twisted logic that Israel gets into in trying to enforce this blockade. So they land on the ship, they know a lot about it, but they don't seem to be ready to be attacked. And when they're attacked, what does this elite commando force do? It panics. That's when people got shot. They didn't land on the ship to kill people. They landed on the ship, got attacked, and panicked and started shooting to save their own lives. That shows you a military that's basically incompetent and an intelligence service that didn't do its job. And that's what's really terribly disturbing when you look at Israel these days and how aggressive its policies and its postures are around the world. It acts on bad information, gets into terrible situations, panics, and then calls on other people to either save it or accuses them of merely hating Israel and just hating people in Israel for any reason whatsoever.
Latest poll says Israelis, you may see it that way, but that Israelis pretty strongly still support this government, Chris.
Well, they do. They do. And it's like watching people walking themselves off the plank. It is, that's their right, absolutely. But I think Israelis should understand that this government is farther and farther from the rest of the world and is isolating Israel more and more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the uproar over Israel's show of force in the Mediterranean, the blockade of Gaza, a relief flotilla, and this week's bloody pushback. with Christopher Dickey, Mideast Regional Editor for Newsweek, joining us from Paris, with Diana Boutou. She is an Arab-Israeli now living and practicing law in the West Bank. She joins us from Ramallah today. And Ehud Eran is here, served on the foreign policy staff of Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He's spent 7 years in the Israeli army, currently reserve major there. Sam in Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good show, and I hope everybody do support this show to keep it going, because it brings what nobody wants to bring up. Now, we have been talking about the deaths, the loss of life in the high sea. We're talking about the threat to Israel, our ally. We talk about the blockade. Nobody is talking about the third factor here, the real confounding variable, the greatest loser, which is us, we, the United States of America. Every deja vu all over again. Last time it was the assassination in Dubai, when we were trying to get somewhere to put Jimmy back in the bottle when it comes to the Iranian nuclear program. And now it looks like we are getting somewhere again. Bang. Deja vu all over again. When we went to Iraq, I'm sure the Israeli government was notified so that they can, because they are our ally, they are our friends, just like most other friends in that area, to make sure that they are well prepared and know what's going on. Did they not in any way or fashion notify the United States that they are in fact going to do this? When Prime Minister is on the way to meet Barack Obama.
Sam, I take your point, though I guess, nobody planned for exactly this kind of death toll, certainly didn't hope for it, I can only imagine. But Ehud Eran, how about it? We already had a fairly high stress level between the Obama administration and the government in Israel. This came exactly, as you said, as Prime Minister Netanyahu was scheduled to meet with President Obama. What are the consequences of this for this relationship, this core relationship?
Well, it still remains to be seen, because the American position was not clear-cut. On the one hand, support for an investigation, but it wasn't clear.
Of the raid.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But it's not clear how much they'll insist on an international investigation or an Israeli investigation. Now, the event should not come as a surprise, as this was in the agenda for a few months. This was well-known.
The flotilla being organized and a raid, yeah.
So this is not a case where Israel surprised the United States, but the potential effects are a continued erosion of support to Israel and the Israeli and the American public, as we hear from some of your mm-hmm. listeners, mm-hmm. And a potential investigation which will further isolate Israel in a moment where the U.S. administration, stressed the need to work with allies as part of its national security policy.
Diana, let me read you a comment here from the website. This is from Grace. She says, please do not be superficial or naive. This was no pacifist situation. There were infiltrations of serious political operatives, and this was not a peace group on the ship in the flotilla. What do you say to that, Diana?
I find it very interesting that these individuals are now raising this issue after they've killed so many activists. But rather, I think that if they really have serious concerns about the names, who are all in fact listed on various websites, or about the goods that were being carried, which of course were checked in the ports of exit, that why is it that Israel's not going to allow for an independent investigation of both the individuals who are on the passenger ships as well as the goods? It seems to me that what Israel's supporters, or the supporters of this massacre, really want to do is they want to silence any sort of dissent that is emerging from this raid and from an illegal action. And what they are doing is they're using a sort of spaghetti approach. They throw everything against the wall and hope that somehow something will stick. But so far, Israel hasn't been able to answer basic questions, which are how many people have been killed? What are the nationalities and the names of these people? What's actually happening to the individuals who are being held in detention, most of whom haven't been allowed to see any lawyers? Why is it that Israel views itself as being above international law? The raid itself was illegal. These are the basic things that Israel has failed to respond to.
I thought that everybody was released. Maybe I have that wrong, Diana, but I thought I saw news reports this morning that they were deporting everybody involved with this.
they so far have not deported everybody that's involved. They've deported some who agreed to be voluntarily deported, including a mother who was carrying her child. But by and large, there's been a media blackout on this issue. But so given that there's a media blackout, the fact that we get these pro-Israel supporters coming forward and saying that they have special information that they're infiltrators is quite ridiculous. I think that really this begs the question of why is there no independent international investigations into Israel's actions.
Ehud, here's a question from a listener who says, please ask your Israeli guest why the government of Israel refuses to publish a list of goods that are under embargo. Is there no list? We heard earlier about, you know, this but not coriander, this but not. I mean, I'd kind of like to know what was on the ships, if they have all the ships in their custody now.
Yeah, as far as I know, the list of what's allowed in and out is public, and my Palestinian colleague just mentioned it. So Israel stresses that some things that are disallowed entry do support the production of missiles and shells and so on. However, I tend to agree with Ms. Bhutto. Some of the items on the list are should not be there.
Here's some of the sound of the radio communications of the Israeli forces as they raided the Turkish-flagged ferry, the Mavi Marmara. Sound was provided by the Israeli Defense Forces. And ultimately, you see in the video that down on the deck, things were not going well. It was a mess down there, and the outcome: 9 dead activists. AJ in Lansing, Michigan. AJ, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for the time here. I just have a couple issues here. I'm trying to sort the whole thing out. I'm sure like many people are. So I'm listening earlier, you know, and you have this person, I'm not sure his name, but he said he was an ambassador or something. He was on one of the
Edward
boats.
Peck, yes.
Yes. And he, you know, and I have an issue with him because, you know, in one part he says, well, you know, when you ask him what did you think was going to happen, hopefully he says, well, you know, we were hoping, you know, we thought maybe the Israelis would get on and usher us off, kind of, and take the goods, you know, deliver the goods. Well, then, in the next minute, you know, you guys are talking about the assault, and he says, well, they were coming on the boat. What did you, what, you know, we had right to defend ourselves. So that right there, I mean, you know, and I see the video, you know, I see him throwing an Israeli person off a boat. You know, I didn't see any gunfire at that point.
But it wasn't long before you can see the pistols raised, and it's hard to tell exactly what's going on. I mean, well, AJ, we take it. I mean, it was a mess. Ehud, Iran, you heard Christopher Dickey saying, we have this impression of Israeli intelligence and Israeli military as highly competent, but it seems to be eroding. And here's another example where this is anything but a well-executed operation.
Yeah, let me just start say one word about the composition of the people that were met by the Israelis. There is a mixture of groups of traditional peace activists, perhaps like Ambassador Peck, combined with a Turkish group, Islamic Charity called IHH, which from early interviews of the Israeli authorities seems did prepare and did bring some of those knives and sticks. So it's not a homogeneous group of either peace activists or a horrible fundamentalist.
But though the group you name, I mean, they may have fundamentalist connections. They've also done relief work, even in Haiti. And,
absolutely.
It's a textured picture here.
Exactly. To your question, as for the Israeli military, I think there are four mistakes. One, lack of intelligence and feeling that it will all go very easy. Secondly, as your guest from Paris noted, putting the wrong people, special forces and Navy SEALs unit rather than a policing type unit. They were given the wrong, as the chief of staff already admitted, they were given the wrong equipment, not enough non-lethal weapons, and therefore were very quickly pushed to use arms. And finally, in Israel's own image, it's actually a result of a restraint, and the chief of the Navy already said they could have used much more force.
You say Israel's portraying it as a restrained outcome.
In its own image. I'm talking about
In its own view of what happened.
Exactly.
There. Yeah, yeah. Greg in Evansville, Indiana. Greg, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I just had a comment, and it's usually hard to make a comment in regards to Israel without being anti-Semitic, but it just seems as if, and with all the allies we have, they're the only ally we have that we can't use in any Middle Eastern conflict, and that their actions are really bringing us closer to a nuclear event than, you know, any conflicts in the Koreas or any of the other hotspots in the world. And I do agree with the panelists that's in France that their incompetency reflects that maybe they should refrain from using so much military force.
Greg, I appreciate your call. Christopher Dickey, I mean, this word incompetence is not one that's historically been associated with Israeli security forces or intelligence. You hear Greg there saying, you know, kind of what's the use here? Though historically there's been plenty of cooperation between the U.S. and Israel in military terms. But there's that skepticism that an incident like this, I suppose, will only reinforce.
Well, that's right. I mean, you have to look back 30, 40 years to the reputation that Israel used to have. After the 1967 Six-Day War, it defeats all the Arab armies in 6 days.
Yeah.
Stunning victory. 1976, it carries out a commando raid to free all the hostages being held in Entebbe in the middle of Uganda, in the middle of Africa. Netanyahu's brother was a leader of that mission and was killed in that mission.
Hero,
the hero.
There, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's the image that Israelis have of themselves and that most of the world had of Israel. Sure, there was a lot of opprobrium heaped on Israel after some of these events, but people also sort of grudgingly said, boy, these guys are tough. They can really do it. If you want to do this kind of thing, Mossad, Israeli Special Operations Forces, these are the people who can really deliver the goods. But at least since 2006, that just hasn't been the case. It's been obvious that Israel has picked some very bad fights for itself in southern Lebanon, to some extent even in Gaza. 2008-2009, for several weeks, they're killing hundreds and then more than 1,000 people in Gaza to crush Hamas, and they fail. They fail. So you've got this long record of public relations disasters since 2006 that are also operational failures.
What
they not only create bad blood, bad will, they fail to achieve their objectives. It doesn't look good.
What are the consequences for Israel of this turning south of its relationship with Turkey, which was quite good for a very long time?
Well, it may have been inevitable that there was going to be something of a downturn in that relationship. And we may be seeing some posturing on the part of Prime Minister Erdogan and Foreign Minister Davutoğlu, who are interested in pursuing a regional policy that puts them a lot closer to Arab states in the neighborhood and also to Iran. So I think it's not only Israel's fault. This is a two-way street. But it's also true that Israel doesn't have a lot of friends in the neighborhood, and Turkey was an extremely important one. You did have a lot of tourists going from Israel to Turkey. You'd run into them in Istanbul all the time.
Yeah.
And it gave Israel a sense of breathing room in an area where it feels, in fact, more and more confined and constrained. To take that away, and you really just have Israel as this little outpost hanging on by its fingernails in an increasingly hostile environment.
Maria in Wrentham, Massachusetts. Maria, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm an Iranian that I had to leave my country after the revolution in
mm-hmm.
Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be from that area to understand the mentality of the people and the way they believe. I think Israel has all the right to defend itself. It has the right because you see in the last 30 years that I can remember, Iran and the countries that are against Israel through the ship, through the peace mission and all that stuff that's going on, they accomplish what they want to accomplish, and Israel has the right and have to and must defend itself. Otherwise, if Israel gives up, unfortunately, that part of the world becomes the Nazi German that they want to do whatever they want.
What about the Palestinians, Maria?
A Palestinian, unfortunately, as I mentioned before, Tom, I was born in that region, and I know from the day, even the child in mother wombs, they are trained to be terrorists, and they are trained to hate other people that have decent life, and they are the people who preach something that they don't believe on it. Like, if it was this same thing happened in Turkey, on Iran, or in Palestine, the people who were on board of the ship, they would be arrested, they would be kept in confinement, they were forced to put, you know, cover their heads. The woman were so...
Maria, we've got our time is short. Diana Butu, what about, does this may not leave Israel better off, whether or not it had to be done, does it leave the Palestinians better off in Gaza or elsewhere?
Absolutely not. I think it's very important to remember that this is not a question of Israel defending itself. This is a question of Israel trying to defend an illegal blockade that the international community has come forward and said that is illegal. It used illegal means to defend that, to try to uphold that illegal blockade. So this isn't a question of Israel defending itself. I think that the bigger question that we need to look at is that of the siege. Should the siege be allowed to continue? Should Israel, and my answer is no. And more importantly, Israel now must be held accountable. This is not just a question of Israel acting against the Palestinians, but we've seen time and again that this is a question of Israel acting against other players in the region. And so now is the time that Israel needs to be held accountable. If it does not, then we will continue to feed this mindset that the only way out of everything is violence. Because if Israel continues to be held to a different standard of law than the rest of the nations of the world, then all that that creates is a cycle in which there is more and more violence and people are more and more posturing to get their rights upheld. This is the cycle that needs to be broken now, and the only way that it can be done is if Israel is held accountable.
Ehud Eran, do you see that kind of self-examination going on in Israel, or the opposite?
There's public support for the general move, criticism of the fiasco, and early conversation about does the siege work or not.
I'm reading here Bradley Burstyn in, again, Haaretz, saying we're no longer defending Israel, we're now defending the siege. He writes, the siege itself is becoming Israel's Vietnam.
Yeah, absolutely. There is early signs of conversation. I myself went on record in the New York Times this morning proposing re-examining the siege.
Well, what a difficult week with real losses on many fronts. And I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Diana Butu in Ramallah, thank you very much for joining us today from the West Bank, Diana.
My pleasure.
Ehud Eran with me in the studio, former staffer for then Prime Minister Ehud Barak's foreign policy staff. Thank you for joining us. And Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief for Newsweek, joining us from Paris. Christopher Dickey, always great to have you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.